We need to offer that to our kids.
Thank you. Thank you. I would like to thank all of our guests for being here for our October show, and also a couple of announcements. The Coalition of Black Trade Unionists meets the second Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. at the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employee William Lucy Building, located at 6025 East Burnside, Portland, Oregon. Join us for our next meeting on October 11th, 2016. Our email address is orcbtu1010@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Join us in our evolving adventure of representing Black union members.
And Audrey? I just want to say that the Dr. Audrey Trail Institute will be having a college fair October 22nd from 8 to 4 p.m., 8th graders through the 12th graders. Please come, not only preparing for college, but we will also tell you how to, there are alternatives, which is what we've been talking about in the past 30 minutes. So let's end by saying we will vote yes on 98 and yes on 97.
And with that, we're out for the month of October. Thank you for joining us. Holla.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The time is 6:30 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Prison Pipeline.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. On August 31st, Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill presented plans to bring the LEAD program to Portland. LEAD, or Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, is a pre-booking diversion pilot program that was developed to address crimes in King County, Washington. The program allows law enforcement officers to redirect low-level offenders engaged in drug or prostitution activity to community-based services instead of jail and prosecution.
The LEAD program, it is a program that began in 2011, effectively, as far as implementation date, up in King County, Washington. Think Seattle and think downtown Seattle, and more specifically, as I've come to understand, the Belltown area of the downtown core of Seattle was where the pilot project began in that 2011 time period up in King County. Now, what's the background behind it? What was their impetus for doing something that has been determined to be really the first in the country of a harm reduction model as it relates to drug addiction and the intersection of law enforcement and prosecution? As I've come to learn through conversations, Dan Satterberg, who is the King County equivalent of me, they call him prosecuting attorney. Here we're called district attorneys, but the King County prosecuting attorney, Dan, and I are friends. We've had numerous conversations about this program and the notions behind it. It stemmed out of a longstanding lawsuit that was brought by numerous members of the community about their concerns of the disproportionate number of individuals of color being arrested for drug-related offenses in King County, and more specifically and directly as it relates to the downtown core area. Years worth of litigation and a lot of frustration on a lot of folks' part, no doubt. What came out of that was a desire to, what can we come up with to help make our community better, and just this joint conversation of a lot of system partners to come up with the LEAD model. The LEAD model has been, and it's now been in place about 5 years. It's been studied internally by members of the program itself, but more importantly, really, it's been studied externally by the University of Washington as they looked at data that is important to, kind of common measures of at least a public safety's opinion of success, right? What are the common things that we look at relative to, is this a successful program versus something other than that? And so it's important to have, you know, an outside agency without presumed biases and such, or defensiveness and that kind of thing, look at the program. And they did that. And they finished their phase one, their first of what is planned to be three significant studies. They finished it in 2015 and published a report. And so the publishing of that report resulted in a lot of interest, to include my own, but a lot of interest around the country about what appear to be some very significant successes as it relates to the LEAD program. Now, I'm talking a lot about it. I'm giving you some background about what piqued my interest and others. But what's important and what's really kind of interesting and I find fascinating is, all right, how does it work, right? What are the details of this program? What are you really talking about? So this jurisdiction has been well known, in fact, frankly, nationally known for its numerous programs, what we tend to call as a group, specialty courts, alternatives to jail, alternatives to prison. We had what is known to be the second in the country drug diversion program run through the courts. The acronym for that is STOP, and STOP program came about 1992, and has existed for now decades. We have a START program, we have a DISP program, we have a deferred sentencing relative to domestic violence. We have a number. More recently, we have the MCJRP program, the Multnomah County Justice Reinvestment Program, tied in with House Bill 3194. So numerous programs. What nobody really in the country ever had was something that was further upstream, because everything that I've summarized involves lawyers with suit and ties, judges with robes on and court proceedings and dockets and all of those things commonly referred to as diversion courts. This is a notion of getting us out of that business, us being prosecutors, not completely out, but mostly out. Defense attorneys, mostly out. Judges, mostly out. Parole and probation, mostly out. As you were introducing yourself, I was a little bit noting how many of you are dealing with folks on the reentry side. You know, understandably, that's why you're here, for the reentry conversation. But what we're talking about is avoiding that notion of things. And can we actually get upstream such that we're having conversations about not sending the people to jail at all, not sending individuals to prison at all, and can we do good by that? So what this looks at then is, I'll make up a fact scenario, not a difficult one, but a kind of a commonly seen one. And you could almost make it right over here, unfortunately, right around the corner, right, where maybe a law enforcement officer or a citizen comes upon and reports to law enforcement a situation where someone is using a controlled substance. Let's make it heroin. And let's just be a little bit direct about it. Let's say that the person is injecting heroin at the time. And a law enforcement officer comes upon that situation. And what follows in the short kind of clipped version of things is a contact with that individual who's possessing that controlled substance. It's going to be a felony. Let's make it that, right? They're injecting, in the process of injecting heroin, have a syringe nearby and or other associated things that go with that. The individual's going to be arrested. They're going to be handcuffed. They're going to be placed in the squad car. Their belongings and evidence is going to be gathered and such. They're going to be brought to a police facility, and they're going to be talked to, they're going to be interviewed, Miranda rights and such, because what we have now is the probable cause and an arrest scenario. And at some point, near the end of the processing and the investigation aspect of that case, is going to come a time where, okay, what do we do next? And that time, for the purposes of this conversation, is when we're preparing to stand, please stand up, I'm going to take you to jail now and lodge you, right, for PCS one, right? Possession of a controlled substance, schedule one for the possession of the heroin that I've just talked about. And so it's at that juncture that we're now going to provide a different option to law enforcement. And that different option is, okay, we can do that, which I've just summarized, or I'd like to come up with another alternative for you under this scenario. And that is, I'd like to call a case manager. And I'd like that case manager to come down and work with you and be assigned to you and for you to participate and sign up in a new program called LEAD, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. So now you see why the law enforcement aspect of this is going to come out of the mouth of a police officer at a precinct almost always. We have different situations, and I'll get a little more in detail of what I'm talking about. But it's at that time that a choice will be made. I like to think, and especially after we're up and running, we'll see what Seattle saw, which is more often than not that sounds like a great idea. Let's not go the jail route. Let's not have me lodged in jail. And I'll kind of carry that through for a little bit to see what we're not going to be doing under the model of this program. What would happen next? Let's say that it was a rejection of that offer. Nope, I'm not ready for your LEAD model. I don't know what it is. let's go the classic route, the route that we've been doing for decades now. And that would include, of course, the bookend process and the lodging in a jail. And how deep or how long goes in the jail, let's not spend a lot of time on that for a while, but it goes in that direction. The police officer submits their reports to my office. My office receives those reports, we review them. Let's presume that we issue the case based on the analysis that I've just summarized. And so we charge the individual with the felony crime of possession of a controlled substance, Schedule 1. We have an arraignment. We have the appointment of counsel more often than not. We have a scheduled docket, and we put this on the trial docket. We insert them into various forms of the diversion options, if eligible, and such. And we go down the road of what you might call business as usual that we've been doing for a very long time relative to the criminal prosecution of this individual. Well, let me back up, because here in this program, we didn't do any of that, right? But instead, the individual who has significant addiction-related issues and needs some assistance, no doubt in a myriad of ways, because as we all know, it's not all the time, certainly, that we are just dealing with a drug addiction issue, right? The overlap is with mental health. The overlap is with homelessness, with absence of jobs, with not knowing how to access SSI if they're eligible. Again, I'm back to, you guys are the experts. You know what I'm talking about. So many layers of things that this individual in the situation that they find themselves in are really not able to work their way through that. So we're going to assign them a case manager, somebody whose actually job it's going to be to work with them on a harm reduction model. And here's the difference now. I've learned more about harm reduction in the last year or two than I ever knew before that in the previous 25 years of doing this work. So I'm still learning. You guys will correct me if I get any of this wrong. But certainly the desire here, I want to contrast the classic probation court involvement programs that we have existing. They still have their place in our community, but they're based on abstinence premises, right? When you're in those programs, you can't use that controlled substance. If you do, you're in violation of the program rules or probation or any other such thing. And we oftentimes look at conversations about swift and certain sanctions and such. And I'm not saying that that sometimes is inappropriate. What I am saying is, let's look at a different model and see if we can come up with a different methodology for approaching this using a harm reduction. Some of you probably grabbed this operating document. At times, maybe I'll spend a minute and refer to it, because some of the deeper important versions of what I'm touching on are found in the four corners of this document. I think it's very important. I want to emphasize it has a word draft on it, right? There's a reason for that. This is a work in progress. You can see the date on it, I think. I'm not looking at it right now, but I think it's June 22nd of this year. My office has been working on numerous kind of versions of this. You're in possession of the most recent version. But the harm reduction model, it's actually on page one in the harm reduction philosophy. So it's this notion that success is not always derived from a belief of complete abstinence, but instead, can we help you move in that direction, right? Can the use of a certain amount of controlled substance, and the next week we've reduced that in half, but you're still using, but we've reduced it because we're working with you and we're heading in a direction of reduction of the harm that's being done to yourself and the community, can that be a good thing? And the answer is yes. Under this model, that's a good thing. And so it's using that as a methodology in pursuit of ultimate success for the person. What's going to have to be a high degree of kind of classic tolerance, right? And when I say tolerance, I mean we need to be willing to not just say it, but embrace the fact that we're going to have individuals in our program who are going to have challenging moments, are going to continue it oftentimes to have controlled substances be part of their life as they work their way through the program that we're going to offer them. So somebody might be thinking, well, how long is that program? And the answer is, as long as it takes. We're not going to have, all right, once you're on the case manager's client list, you got 6 months to straighten it all out, right? Or 12 months or 18 months. The answer is, as long as it takes. Now, a little bit more about the case managers. And we're stealing, maybe stealing is a wrong word for a prosecutor to say. We're replicating the Seattle model as best we can. Why? As I mentioned early on, talked a large handful of times with the King County prosecutor. Got his perspective, but I also took a trip up and spent a couple days being toured through their program, meeting with people who are given the direct services, some of the actual case managers, the law enforcement, boots on the ground that are working with this population. So I learned a handful of things out there, and that is, don't change the recipe, because if you change the recipe, you may not derive the success that we have seen. So that translates to me of, while it's important for us to customize where appropriate because we're Portland and not Seattle, there actually are more similarities than differences as it relates to this conversation, especially as it relates to their pilot project and its physical location and ours, which you're in it, right? The plan for the pilot project here in Portland is going to be in the high pedestrian area as defined by the Portland City Code. But essentially, I'm just going to overly summarize by saying you're almost in the epicenter of it, and it's going to spread south for us some, north for us, cross a river a little into the Lloyd District and such, right? And so it's our downtown core area. It's going to be predominantly enforced on the pilot project aspect of things by the Central Precinct of the Portland Police Bureau. Still some work in progress about some of those deeper details, but I'm giving you, I hope, a sense of what's in store for us. Because we're modeling their program and we're learning from their attempts to, and how they've gotten it as best they can in the 5 years that they've done this, a recipe that seems to be working for them is to have an expectation that your case managers, those are going to be these individuals who are experts in the field like yourselves, having in the neighborhood of 25 to 30, it can maybe bump up to 35, but the sweet spot in there is that 25 to 30 number of clients on any given time. The number that they began with was about 10 case managers, and so when you do the quick math, at any given time when they were up and running in the early goings of things, they had about 300 individuals who were in this program. We're expecting and we're looking at starting at about the same size from how many case managers is Multnomah County looking at contracting? What's the pilot project? And we've run some numbers relative to our expectations of individuals that are being submitted to my office for prosecution consideration already. And I'll simplify it by saying, we're thinking that number 300 at any given time is about what we'll see once we're up and operational. Another question that might occur to you is, what's that mean? Does that mean 300 per year and there's a cap? And the answer is, no, not quite. Some people who are going to enter into that program, the lead program, may find themselves having success quite soon. And that would be great. They could move into the not needing much attention. Say, I'll just make it up 6 months later, allowing that case manager to add another person. And you see the rotational nature of things. While at the same time, there's going to be individuals who are, hey, it's been 18 months and I'm still working on it, right? 24 months still working on it. So we've got to have some flexibility, but we've got to recognize that there's a tipping point relative to our positive productivity on case manager caseload. So that 25, 30, 35 is about the range.
You are listening to a presentation on August 31st by Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill.
So a little bit more of, all right, where are things? I'll shift gears a little bit. We can go back to some of the details about operationally how would this work. Let me give you a sense of timeline. So if you're reading this document, now remember this is whatever it was, the fifth iteration of this draft or so. But on June 16th, I wrote in there, and when I say I've got a team within my office working on this with me. So it's not all my original thinking, trust me on that. I've got a group of prosecutors who are very experienced in this area that are working with me, or I've got to actually literally have an assigned deputy district attorney to this program. Her name is Nicole Herman, for the anticipation of up and running and boots on the ground. And so she's working on this with me and Jim Hayden, who's a downtown core neighborhood prosecutor. But you'll see on page two, I wrote summer or fall, right, of 2016. Summer or late fall. So it's overly enthusiastic as a practical reality matter. So let me give you a realistic. I'd like to think that we're operational and having our first clients participating with case managers in January of 2017. So a small handful of months away. We're moving fast on things. What do we need to do to get ourselves there? And it starts with confirming the principles in this document, taking away the word draft on it, right? And that's a work in progress. We're closing in on getting very close. Everybody's in agreement to almost everything. But what we want to do is get our project manager in place. So structurally, if you think, what's this going to look like? So I'll back up and I'll talk a few numbers and answer that question. I was a proponent, together with some others, who met with the county officials, specifically our county chair, Deborah Cafori, and then also our four city and county commissioners. Met with them independently and met with them in groups and testified in front of them at least two, maybe three different times in my support and enthusiasm for going in this direction from a public safety law enforcement standpoint. Me and others were convincing, and our chair and the four county commissioners set aside what amounts to a total of $1 million to do this pilot project. The $1 million is in this fiscal year, but it was set aside for us to spend this year to do this work that I'm outlining. Now, $1 million, that's a lot of money. We spent a lot of time, myself and my staff, working with the King County Prosecutor's Offices and leadership up there with, all right, what does it cost to do what I'm talking about? What's the operational expense? All right, that is Seattle, after all, it's Portland. There are some customizations and a little bit different. In fact, they had about $800,000 in their first operational year, 2011, and they were able to get themselves up and going. Each month that goes by is us not spending a dime, and so will we have enough to do our vision starting in, if I say, January? Yeah, there's every expectation we will, for sure. So that gives you a sense of the money. $800,000 out of general fund and another $200,000 out of a MacArthur grant that this county received here within the last year or so. What's the future for it? You'll also read in here, this is a pilot for Multnomah County. We need to make it work. I have every expectation this is going to be a resounding success, a lot like it is up in Seattle. But we're still calling it pilot because that's appropriate. We need to prove that it works. But back to a little bit more of the logistics. So what's going on right now? As I mentioned, working on this document, finalizing it, making sure that we've got our foundational concepts. We are in the process of hiring a program director. I was part of a group of, there was four or five of us that reviewed applications by a number of, you know, highly qualified individuals from around the, not just this community, but the region, right, who are interested in being the program manager for Multnomah County's lead program. And I fully expect that we'll have the program manager identified and likely working inside of 30 days from now. That's why this is also says draft, is that person needs to set eyes on this, right, and needs to help us to get this right. What's the other next step, but also simultaneous step, and that is figuring out who we're going to work with that's going to be in charge of the case managers. That's an important, important job. And so the county is considering, are they going to put this out for contract? Are they going to contract with one of the local service providers who will then, from a contract standpoint, be in charge of the employment, the HR side of the case managers? I don't mean to be suggestive, but for example, Volunteers of America, Central City Concern, whomever, just by way of example, that's not at all suggestive, but by way of example, we can't start until that's in place. My office, myself, we've met with the leadership of the Portland Police Bureau. They are completely on board. New Chief Mike Marshman and his leadership, they're working with us hand in hand, as are others, because they're a critical partner. Remember I talked about critical partners? They're as important as the case managers, because we need them to ask the question, should I take you to jail or should I call a case manager? And they've got to be on board. I wasn't there for it because I had to miss it, but we had a think tank with the Streets Crimes Unit and members of the Central Precinct, the folks that are walking, you know, patrolling this, literally this area and the area that we're talking about, and they are enthusiastic about having this as another option for an alternative to the classic insertion into jail and the trajectory of convictions and the collateral consequences that go with that conviction. So, all right, what's success going to look like? What can we expect? What do we want out of this? So, back to a little bit of statistics. Remember the University of Washington study. You know, looking at the document and some of the jump out to you positive things that their program seems to have managed to find success in, and that is recidivism. So for those of you who don't know what recidivism is, essentially it's reoffending, right? Once you have a controlled date, an event date, and then after that date, what happened? Did you get rearrested? Did you reoffend? Did you recidivate, right? And so they developed a control group. This was a non-randomized study, but nonetheless found to be very high, maybe not the triple gold star level study with randomized controlled study, but one level next to that. And what they found is, you know, a couple of statistics in that area, that over the first 6-month period of time, the 58% lower odds of at least one arrest, by the lead-based involved group versus this control group. They tease out warrant-related arrests. It moves into 34% lower odds of arrests. I'll just read this quote. The proportion of lead participants charged with at least one felony decreased by 52% subsequent to the evaluation entry, meaning entry into the lead program. They summarize it with a paragraph. I'm looking at a whole page of deeply researched material with significant figures in the neighborhood of what I just said, 30, 40, 50, and knocking on 60% reduction in recidivism by pointing out that this is a highly, highly significant result in a positive way, certainly. That is, recidivism analysis is one of the most commonly done analyses of success in a public safety conversation. So that's not lost on anybody how important that is. Now, let me back up and talk to you about, remember when I mentioned the LEAD program came out of significant years worth of litigation surrounding this fact that a disproportionate number of individuals of color were being arrested and prosecuted in King County for drug-related possession offenses. We see that here. We see that in Multnomah County, and it's troubling. And people like me, my office, and many others want to do something better and more fair and more just in that area. So what happened after they developed the LEAD program? What they found with the control group is, and I'll flip another page, it's about 60% of their participants were individuals of color, and specifically, more often than not, black men. The average age of participation in the LEAD program is 40 years old. The predominant male versus female, I'm going by memory, I think it's in the neighborhood of 65 to 70%, maybe closer to 65, are male and the balance female. So mostly you're talking about 60% of the participants being 40-ish from an age standpoint, black men. They were optimistic that that number of 60% would drop. So success, one of the measurements is going to be, what are we looking at recidivism-wise? Beyond recidivism, there's going to be a lot of anecdotal in this area. We're going to need to listen to the case managers, people like yourselves, frankly, business owners. You know, there's going to be evidence, data, anecdote, which sometimes is evidence as well, storytelling, about successes and people and individuals. I also know, and I'll add to it, but it gets a little squishy. All right, did we actually help people collaterally as I envision this notion? Sometimes in order to be able to answer that question, you really have to look at a years-long lens. In other words, all right, that harm reduction model. Today, we're dealing with someone who's deeply addicted to heroin. 6 months from now, they still are involved in the use of heroin, but boy, they've reduced it to a third or a quarter or a fraction of what was before. And a year from now, they're off heroin, they're working, they're sustaining that. And so now we're out a couple of years. So we've got to have this long lens of looking at success from that kind of storytelling. And that matters a ton, because isn't that at the core of all this, isn't that really what success is? There's going to be different measures of success. Some individuals, CEOs of corporations, would look at, have you saved the county money or the state money overall, right? There will be individuals who are looking at the decimal points and the flow charts of plus and minus dollars. Remember, I outlined what I think nobody quite knows, but all of us can agree that it is a resource-intensive and degrees of expensive process to go through the criminal justice system, the prosecution model, the expense of court docketing and indigent defense and the use of jails, and in some instances, the use of prison for individuals that we're talking about, certainly the prosecution model. I'm talking about not doing any of that and saving that expense to be redirected in different, maybe more necessary areas, right? And so some individuals will derive success as, boy, we spent $1 million, we saved five, okay? Some will look at it that way. Others will look at it the way that we're talking about. Boy, we've out of 300 people that were in the program during a calendar year, 100 no longer use drugs. 20 no longer use drugs. Both are going to be a successful response, right? Maybe you folks know this, maybe not. You know, I was, me and several others, one of the drafters of 3194. I, as a prosecutor, supported 3194. I have been implementing and working hard with our system partners throughout Multnomah County to develop the MCJRP program. 1,000 individuals in any calendar year who are presumed to go to prison come into the program that I helped design. We moved from 450 of those 1,000 being placed on probation historically to closer to between 700 and 750 being placed on probation. We're working what I would call tirelessly to do the right thing in an area that has saved not just money. If you look at money, we, meaning the Multnomah County MCGRP program, estimated in the last biennium we saved the state over $20 million relative to avoided prison costs of sending people that historically have been sent to prison, that we just aren't doing that anymore. And for that, we received $8.1 million in this biennium to reinvest and to work at coming up with programs to reduce recidivism safely while being mindful of public safety, restitution being paid to victims, and all the attendant circumstances of good success.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland and a presentation by Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill at the August Roar Alliance meeting. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline episodes at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher and Afro jazz bandleader, lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it is Hard Knock Radio, so stay tuned.